teaches many subjects at the University of Minnesota, and we are glad to have him here. So please welcome Nabil Montar.
Thank you so much for coming on a nice spring day of snow. I mean, when is spring going to start here? But I guess we'll just have to take it as it comes. I want to thank Callie and Pastor Matthew for inviting me. As I was just telling Pastor Matthew, my mother always wanted me to become a minister. And in my old age, I'm being invited around churches to talk about Islam. And so I'm kind of slowly getting into that position. But right, today I want to kind of perhaps speak for 30, 40 minutes about kind of general Islamic themes and constituents of Islam. Now, I gather that many of you have lived in Muslim countries, and therefore what I say might be too simplistic or too superficial. And therefore, if you want to have a further discussion of that, and we definitely can do that after kind of, you know, in the Q&A, I'd be very happy to do so. As we start to talk about Islam, I think the first point I will always very strongly urge on a Christian community, and having been brought up in a society which was indeed multi-religious in those days in Lebanon, and having a family who was very, very open. I mean, my parents were intensely devout, but it was the kind of devotion that, which in my view is the true devotion, is that every Sunday morning, in true fashion, we would have breakfast as a family, and then my father, who was a lay minister, he was never kind of fully willing to be ordained, would read passages from the Bible. I mean, you can imagine, you know, that for somebody who's 8 or 10 years old is kind of extremely tedious, but we had to sit through it, and which ultimately kind of helped me a lot in life, because I remembered a lot of what we learned. But also being, as I say, intensely devout, my father realized that we lived in a community which was multi-religious, particularly with a Muslim community. And once in a while, he would read passages from the Quran for us as a family and interpret those. So I grew up really, you know, deeply familiar with the two traditions, obviously much more with Christianity, and then later, as I lived and studied and taught in the Middle East, kind of it became by far more an area of expertise and also personal interest. Because I believe in building bridges, and a lot of people don't, whether here or there. And that's why I feel kind of that's what I like to do, is to try and present a perspective on Islam that is accessible in the same way that I try to do also a perspective on Christianity, or I used to do when I lived in the Middle East. Again, that would be accessible. So to start with, I think the first point I make always before a Christian audience is that Islam is like Judaism. The idea that kind of often you hear Judeo-Christian tradition is really an oxymoron. Judaism as a religion is very different from Christianity and very similar to Islam. In the sense that Judaism and Islam are religions of law. And any understanding of Islam and Muslims has to take into account the fact that there are laws that you have to obey. The kind of laws that in the Christian tradition, as you look back at the New Testament, Jesus reacted against and defied and ended up paying the price for that. That is exactly what Islam is. It is a religion of law you have to obey. And in obeying these laws, then, you know, you hope to attain God's favor and reach paradise at the end of life. So it's law, and it's very difficult for Christians. It was very difficult for me to see law in practice and to really come to terms with the dramatic importance and crucial importance of law. And I give an example of an in-law of mine who was a Muslim, and always had long discussions and wonderful discussions in Beirut. But it was most instructive to me to see how law was practiced during Ramadan. Now, Ramadan, as you know, and we'll be talking about that in a few minutes, but Ramadan is a month in which Muslims fast. And nowadays, given kind of the ability to identify exactly the exact minute of the day in which the sun rises, which means you begin your fast, and the exact minute in which the sun sets, which means you break your fast. It was fascinating for me, and as I say, it was perhaps the most instructive scene I had and made me fully understand the significance and the intensity of law, is that he would, you know, he would be fasting, and sometimes the fast is a very, very long fast. In summer, you're looking at 13 hours, 14 hours between around kind of 4 o'clock in the morning and 7 in the evening. So it's really an absolutely exhausting experience, and yet a lot of people, not all obviously, not all Muslims would maintain that, but a lot would. And he would, you know, he would fast, and he would sit when it was kind of, let's say, you break the fast at 7:14 in the evening. And so he would be sitting there with his cup of coffee, his cigarette, and the clock. And he is waiting for 7:14. And the moment it was 7:14, he would take a swig at his coffee and light up his cigarette. And I always had, you know, we had discussions. I said, you know, what's the point? You know, how about 7:13? How about 7? No, you obey God. And in the same way, and you'd always say, you know, you stop at the red light. You don't negotiate that. You don't, you know, discuss it with a police officer if you break it. It's law. And so this is, as I say, the first thing and the most important kind of principle within which we approach Islam is that it is laws, and you have to obey laws and practice these laws. And if you don't, then you are really breaking God's laws. Now, in terms of these laws, it's, you know, where do they come from? For the Muslim, clearly, they come from the holy text of the Quran. The Quran is a very challenging text, again, for a Western audience. I always like to say that the Quran is really the only Semitic text of the three monotheistic revelations. The others were kind of Greekified, if I can use that phrase or term. Quran is a series of revelations that appeared to the Prophet in Mecca and Medina, Prophet Muhammad. He was a merchant, and at the age of 40 or thereabouts, began to have these religious experiences. Experiences that were not terribly unusual at the time. A lot of other Arabs and you know, had these religious kind of moments. And he was much like many of the, or at least some of the people in Mecca who had that religious moment. And often Meccans, when they would have these religious kind of moments, they would leave the city and go out a little bit outside to kind of series of caves that are still there in surrounding Mecca. And just kind of go like monks, ascetical monks, would go there for, you know, kind of solitude, meditation, and, you know, we don't know what kind of invocations he had. And it is at that point that kind of the revelations of the Quran began for him. So the Quran is a series of revelations that will come to the Prophet from the year 610. The very first revelation was on the 27th of the month of Ramadan, which is why the month of Ramadan is so holy, and will end basically with his death in 632. So you're looking at 22 years of divine revelations to the Prophet. Now, these revelations started off initially in Mecca at the very beginning of the message as revelations about two thrusts that the Quran will have. And these are the most important thrusts in the early stage of Islam. First and foremost, there is one God. There are no deities and idols that have to be worshipped. And the second of all is that there is a day of judgment. These are the two kind of, if you want, parameters that the kind of early revelation established. And this is again important as we compare and contrast Islam with Christianity, with Judaism. That Islam again is like Judaism, where the kind of the enemy, the other, the adversary, is the polytheist. As with Judaism and with the early revelations to Moses and the making of the Torah, you know, it was always the kind of those who worshipped other gods, that did not worship Yahweh, did not worship El. So it was, in a sense, Judaism emerged in a context of polarization with polytheists, whatever they were, whoever they were, the worshippers of Baal, the worshippers, etc., all these. Christianity, of course, Jesus was not operating in a polytheist. He was basically working with his own community. Islam is very much like Judaism. Muhammad is very much like Moses. Don't compare Muhammad to Jesus. You compare him to Moses. He belongs to that prophetic tradition, where the enemy is, again, the polytheist. And that was the central enemy for the Quran at the very beginning. I mean, polytheism cannot be tolerated and is not tolerated, neither in the Hebrew scriptures nor in the Quran. So that was the first kind of set the parameters. One God, not deities, not all these idols, and then the Day of Judgment. When the prophet later migrates from Mecca to the city that comes to become, that becomes his kind of headquarters, Medina, the revelations become different and are intensified and become theocratic revelations. In a sense, that is where the laws begin to be revealed to the prophets. What you can eat, what you cannot eat, whom you can marry, whom you cannot marry, who inherits what. I mean, all the laws that are now to constitute a new society, because the migration from Mecca to Medina really built a new society for the Arabs. And so the laws that I was speaking about, fasting, prayer, all the laws that govern a Muslim's life derive primarily from these revelations in the Quran. Now, many of the laws are stated there, but clearly not all laws. And therefore, there is another source by which Muslims abide by the laws and to which they turn for the laws. And that is the Prophet's own interpretation of the revelations, the Prophet's own way of living, the Prophet's own determinations and statements that he made. These become, if you want, a second category that also constitute part of the legal system that Muslims will abide by. So whenever you hear the word Sharia, which is simply means kind of the way of the law, Sharia is simply the kind of configurations of all the laws in the Quran and in the prophetic tradition. The way in which, as I say, the prophet lived, the prophet spoke, and the prophet determined judgments. This is where law comes in, and that is where the Muslim finds the kind of the whole structure of his or her life determined by these laws. Islam, theoretically, is a theocracy, in the same way that Judaism is theoretically also a theocracy. The laws are God's laws, and that's why 7:14, you don't discuss it. This is God. In the Quran, it kind of, obviously, it was much less precise. In the Quran, it actually stated that you begin your fast and break your fast when you can no longer distinguish between a black thread and a white thread. In other words, sunrise and sunset. Nowadays, as I say, you can specify that to the minute, and that is how that law is obeyed. Now, what makes a Muslim, other than the obedience to the law, are five principles that govern, again, and define his meaning as, his or her meaning as a Muslim. So I'll kind of look at these very quickly, the kind of five principles of Islam. Some of you might be familiar with them. I will try to elaborate on them a bit more than kind of the usual perspective on them. The first and the most decisive and the most transformative is that you accept that there is only one God. And as I say, do remember that the beginning of Islam is in a polytheistic society. So it's always, you know, one God, one God, one God. You raise your finger, there's only one God. And so the witness, the shahada, the kind of the attestation to your faith, the profession of faith, is simply a statement. You state that statement, you are a Muslim. Doesn't take anything more than one sentence. And so it's kind of interesting because I was just reading an account of one of the captives in Guantanamo, Muazzam Beg, who was kept there for around 4 years and then released. Nothing was kind of, he was not a terrorist, and yet he was kept there. And it was very interesting that he was saying that, you know, as he was having discussions at some points, not always, of course, with some of the guards, And they would ask him about Islam, and he would ask him about Christianity. And he said some of them actually became Muslim without really knowing it, because they repeated that sentence. For Islam, it just takes one sentence. You don't have to undergo a certain process of education, of indoctrination, of learning. It's one statement, simply because you're supposed to be born a Muslim. You're supposed to be born in submission to God, which is what Muslim means. You're just submitting to the one God. And so the first part of the profession of faith is simply that there is one God. Forget about all these idols that kind of infested Mecca and Medina and basically the whole Arabian Peninsula to a large extent. The second part of the profession is very interesting because it kind of is a deeper kind of sense. And it says, you know, you have to accept one God and you accept Muhammad as his prophet. Now, by using the term prophet, the Quran and Islam in general recognizes that there are other prophets. Muhammad is not kind of a prophet out of the blue. There is a history of a prophetic tradition that the Quran recognizes, accepts, and links itself to it. And that historical, that history of prophetic revelation is obviously manifest in the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, and in the New Testament. So Muslims, by believing in the Quran, by believing in the prophecy that Muhammad brought, have to accept, have to submit that there were two other monotheistic revelations that they also have to accept. The revelation to the Israelites, the Jews, and the revelation through Jesus. And that's why you find Muslims here or all around the world giving children names from the Hebrew scriptures, even the name Jesus, not as it is in the Syriac Arabic, but in the kind of Arabic of the Arabian Peninsula. Many children, Muslim children, are named after Jesus, Isa, and Musa, and Ibrahim, and, you know, Dawood, and, you know, all the names of the prophets, all the prophets in the Hebrew scriptures, up till Jesus, are recognized as prophets, men of God, sent by God to humanity. And these prophets brought the same message from Adam until Jesus, who is the very last prophet before Muhammad, and then Muhammad. They all have one message and one message only. There's one God. There's a day of judgment. That's it. That is the core of the message. So when the witness, the shahada, the statement, the profession of faith, asks you to accept one God and Muhammad, it also asks you to accept the lineage of prophecy. You cannot but accept Jesus as a prophet. You cannot but accept Moses and Abraham and David and Solomon and Aaron. I mean, there are clearly no more prophets than the Old Testament and the Hebrew Scriptures recognizes. Plus, the Quran clearly states that God does not have favorites, and that's why it kind of reacted against Judaism. The idea that there's only one people who were given a message by God, who became a kind of a holy nation, who became a chosen nation, that to the Quran is unacceptable. God has no favorites, and therefore, the Israelites had their prophets, yes, and we know these prophets, both through the Hebrew scriptures and the Quran, but other people elsewhere, all around the world, had also had their prophets. We don't know about them. They've been forgotten. They've kind of, you know, their legacy has been erased. But the principle is that God does not just have one group, cannot have one group. God is God of all. And so in Africa, in America, in Australia, in principle, the Quran would say, all these peoples have had their prophets. And these prophets have all had the same message because they're all coming from the same God, which is that one God, no idols, and therefore, and the exception, the acceptance of the prophetic lineage from, you know, from Adam to Muhammad. So that's the kind of first point about Islam, is that it is really a religion that accepts in a very positive manner the previous two monotheistic revelations. It disagrees with them theologically, but it accepts them in principle. It accepts Judaism as a revelation of God. As I say, all the prophets are prophets of God. It disagrees on what Judaism had built around itself, which is that we are the chosen people and kind of, you know, others are not. That to the Quran is anathema. God does not have favorites. It's kind of the critique, basically, of that Jesus and John the Baptist leveled against the kind of Pharisaic Judaism that they saw in Palestine, in the first century AD. The same thing, you know, when Jesus says God can create out of these stones, sons. You know, when they said we're sons of Abraham, and he kind of retorts, you know, he can create a new people. That critique is exactly the critique that the Quran has of Judaism. In terms of Christianity, it's much more complicated. It's much more theological than, if you want, ethnocentric. I mean, Quran and Islam does not support, although in practice, and as you may have lived in certain Muslim countries, and as you may read, you know, like all societies, they have their ethnic kind of ethnocentricities and racism and racialism. That's fine. But again, in terms of a revelation of a text, there can be none of this kind of ethnocentric identities. And so that's the critique of Judaism. As I say, with Christianity, it's much more complicated. First, because the Quran admires very much a strain of Christianity that was very strong in the Arabian Peninsula, and that it kind of really praised to a level that is quite impressive. And that is the whole monastic tradition, the monks and the nuns that obviously were there mainly in Medina, to some extent in Mecca, but really, I mean, there were communities of Christians in the Arabian Peninsula, as there were obviously Jews, although the largest, as I said, was the kind of the polytheist. So it admired certain features of Christian life. It admired them so much that today, you know, when you see a Muslim woman dressed according to the Quranic code, which is that the face should be revealed, this idea of wearing a kind of a hijab is not Islamic. This is cultural. This is not Quranic. You have to have the face revealed, the whole body is covered, the hands and the feet are kind of, you know, manageable. That is what the Quran says. And of course, if you look at that, whom does it remind you of? Nuns. And basically, the Quran admired, you know, that whole monastic tradition. And in a sense, when it defined the legal code for a woman's dress, which is stated in the Quran, no question about that, it's looking at nuns. It liked the way nuns were dressed. And so, you know, there was tremendous admiration and kind of ambivalence. You know, they didn't know what to make of these people. I mean, they were very pious, they're very devout, they're living in caves, you know, ascetical, very intense kind of devotions. What it didn't work with at all, and it's the same as with Judaism, could not work with it at all, is the idea of an incarnation. That, to the Quran, is completely anathema. As I say, that's where I would again reiterate Islam and Judaism work together. The idea of the incarnation, obviously, is a Greek idea. It's not Semitic. You don't find it in the Hebrew scriptures unless you really want to push the interpretation of some of the verses in the Old Testament. But the idea of a God assuming a human shape is really a part of the classical tradition, of the Greco-Roman tradition, of, you know, Aeneas in the Virgil's epic, who is, you know, his father is human, his mother is the goddess Venus. And obviously the whole panoply of figures that appear in the classical tradition. I mean, you have lots of people in the classical tradition, in literature basically, who, you know, the father is mortal, the mother is immortal, or divine, and vice versa. So that's why I say it's kind of more Greek, more Hellenistic, more kind of the environment in which Paul operated at the, you know, in the first century AD. So coming back to the Quran, this is one point that it will never accept and the Muslim will never accept. And it's kind of always been fascinating as I have intense discussions about this, because this is really the breaking point. You know, the Quran and Muslims recognize the kind of devotional piety in Christianity, at least in the Quranic perspective of it, tremendously admire it. I mean, perhaps the figure who is most written about in the later traditions is the figure of Jesus. I mean, there are whole narratives and stories about Jesus and his mother, Mary. They kind of always go together. But it's always a Jesus who is an ascet, who is like a monk. He's always kind of poor. He's always kind of walking around, you know, talking to people and, in a sense, denouncing wealth, denouncing affluence, denouncing opulence, and living a very kind of harsh, a very kind of self-contained life. The kind, in a sense, not unlike the Jesus of the New Testament. You know, man with no possessions, with no property, wandering with no house that could keep him. So in a sense, it picked up on that and really admired it for, you know, it goes on and on up till today, which is interesting because there is no place for somebody like Jesus in Islamic life. You know, somebody who is unmarried, who's kind of doesn't live in society, that seems odd. But nevertheless, he is a figure of tremendous admiration there. But not, again I come back, not as an incarnation. So despite, or notwithstanding, the acceptance of the whole prophetic tradition, as I say, there is a difference in terms of how Islam looks at Judaism and how, from the way Judaism sees itself, and of course how Islam looks at Christianity, again from the way Christianity defined itself after the Council of Nicaea in the 4th century. Now, this is where, as I say, it is important to keep these differences in mind. Acceptance, but also disagreement. And what Islam or the Islamic history, achieved was something that was absolutely unique in the period in which it emerged and to a large extent continued until the early modern period, is that it rejected your theology, but accepted you as part of the community. And so that's why Christians and Jews and later others, Zoroastrians and Hindus, as Islam kind of expanded in terms of its regional and geographical scope, it will accept you as part of the community, you live with it, you're a second-class citizen, you're not definitely equal to a Muslim, but you are protected. Again, sometimes yes, sometimes no, but in theory, in law, you are protected, your possessions are protected, your family are protected, you have opportunity to work. I mean, in a sense, it gave you a place in the Islamic city and state and theocracy that no other religion had given to the other. Christianity kind of begrudgingly gave that to Judaism and to the Jews, and of course, from the Crusades on begins a legacy of anti-Semitism. Judaism did not. Judaism is a very ethnocentric kind of tradition, and therefore the theocracy of Judaism is very much self-centered, and the other, the goyim, is outside the frame of reference. So that was kind of, that's the beginning of being Muslim, that you accept God and accept Muhammad in that lineage. Second is prayer, and you're all familiar with Muslims praying 5 times a day. Again, we need to repeat, not every Muslim does that, in the same way that not every Christian or every Jew lives according to his or her religious kind of culture and laws. But in principle, a Muslim has to pray 5 times a day. He has to turn, he and she has to turn towards Mecca as recognizing a kind of a center. And in that respect, it kind of brings a unity to every Muslim anywhere in the world. It's the kind of unity that perhaps medieval Christians had. You know, every cathedral built in the Middle Ages, early Gothic period, kind of Renaissance, maybe up till the Enlightenment, always pointed at Jerusalem. And so whenever you went to church or a cathedral as, you know, a medieval or an early modern Christian, chiefly Catholic, you looked at Jerusalem. So in a sense, it was also that kind of unifying factor that whether you're in Cologne or you're in Amsterdam, well, Amsterdam kind of later, but London, for instance, or Paris, wherever you are, you're always focused on the same place. And therefore, a sense of community for you as, in that period, as Catholics. The same thing for Muslims. Whether you are praying at home, whether you want to pray in that corner here, or you're praying in the mosque, what is important is that you're always focused on Mecca, the kind of the unifying factor there. Prayer is a certain ritual, and in that respect, again, it's a ritual that Christians had, but obviously with the early modern period and the Enlightenment gave up. But the ritual of prostration, of bending down, touching the head to the floor, a total submission. a total obedience, a total self-annihilation before God. This is so fundamentally important for a Muslim, that as you pray, nobody else is there. Not even your family is there. There's only one thing, you're focused on one object, and that is God. And kind of one example I give about the intensity of that focus is I was once sitting in a mosque and just observing as people came to pray. And it was kind of noon prayer, it was very full, and this guy came, abluted, and again, ablution is part of the preparation for prayer, as in Judaism, and then couldn't find a place inside the mosque. So he kind of, you know, went outside, which is where I was sitting, on the kind of a platform, and literally, kind of just in front of the wall, here is a wall, and that is where he was praying. I mean, in front of him was this wall. You don't need to see anything because you're looking at this absoluteness of God. And you don't need to have anyone with you. At the end of prayer, so the intense focus on the oneness of God, the absoluteness of God, the unknowability of God. You know, you can't see God. You can't configure his name. You cannot configure his quality. I mean, you can think about them. But ultimately, God is an absolute beyond human reach. And that's why it didn't matter. You know, he can sit there and literally have his whole wall in front of him. It's kind of, you know, blocking your vision. It doesn't matter. What you're looking at is beyond that towards God. Now, at the end of prayer, you come back to humanity. But as you are praying, as I say, it's like a tunnel vision at God. But it's very interesting that once a prayer, and you may have seen that in kind of television or you know, whatever, that at the end of prayer, the individual will turn to the left and to the right and will say, "Assalamu alaikum, peace be with you." So it's like, I have reached God or I have worshipped God, now I come back and greet those next to me. People, angels, whoever is next to me. Because it, you know, you would also do that even if there's no one, even if you're just praying at home on your own. There are the angels that are around you, and so you salute them as you would salute the, you know, individuals, fellow co-religionists. Prayer is also like fasting, very strictly timed. As I say, it has a certain specific number of prostrations. I mean, obviously you can add if you want, but there's a minimum. There's a certain kind of, you know, repetition of prayers that you kind of invoke. So it's highly kind of controlled in that respect. And then there is obviously, on a Friday, there is a sermon given by the imam. Now, the concept of imam has always been problematic because it changes in the traditions of Shiaism, and I'll talk about that. But basically, imam is a leader of prayer, any man. Although now, I think, 2 or 3 months ago, was the first case where a woman led prayer in London, in a mosque in London, and there was a big kind of discussion. Not terribly happy, but a big discussion about that. But the imam is basically a leader of prayer. He is not an ordained minister. He is not necessarily trained as a theologian. He is simply one of the community whom we admire, who is learned. I mean, obviously, he has to impress us. Clearly a man of virtue and piety. We're not going to have an imam, a leader who's a drunk, so, you know, somebody whom we respect. And, you know, he would know a bit about his religion, about his theology. But any man, you know, if we're traveling and we're 7 of us and we decide to pray, you know, any of us, perhaps the best among us, whom we would all say, well, you know, you're a more pious man than I am, could lead prayer. So, kind of prayer is a very communal act, but as I say, ultimately a tunnel vision at God. Timed per day, the muadhan, kind of, you know, you're called to prayer, you're reminded of prayer. All these are kind of paraphernalia of it that really began with the advent of Islam. The Prophet himself kind of witnessed the first call to prayer by one of the slaves that had been manumitted, an Ethiopian by the name of Bilal. He was the first man to call prayer in the city of Medina. Mosque design, I don't know if, and you've been to mosques, some of you again, I'm sure you have, others haven't, and I hope be occasion for you to visit a mosque here. I mean, you're going to find it much less ornate than this. I mean, even this, as a Lutheran kind of church, is a bit too kind of colorful, which is quite nice. But a mosque could be just, it's like a Baptist church, very kind of, Southern Baptist church, because again, you have various Baptists, and the kind of Baptists that I kind of saw a lot of in Florida. Basically a room. Something like that even would be possible. No ornamentation. No, obviously for the Protestant, that's very easy to access. No statues, no icons, nothing. No color. It doesn't matter. It's just a plain old room. What you need are two things, and that's all. You need to have a direction to prayer. So instead of having kind of equivalent to an altar, although it's not an altar, it's simply a pointer. This points towards Mecca. So it's just a direction to prayer. It's not a holy place. It's not sacrosanct as perhaps in the Catholic tradition where, only the priest steps up there. And the other thing you would need to have to the right of that direction of prayer, simply an elevated platform. It's a pulpit. It's kind of around 6 or 7 steps higher. And obviously that was kind of practical in those days. If you wanted to preach, you needed to kind of go up higher so that your voice would carry. These two are really the essentials of a mosque. Nothing else is. You walk into the mosque, as I would imagine in churches as well, in synagogues, you line up. Very importantly, the equality of humanity before God. That you line up. You could be here next to your police chief, you could be next to the president. The point is that you're all equal, you're lining up, and that was part of the symbolism of it, that there is no difference between Muslims. All are kind of equal before God. And then kind of line up here, then another line. For men, women will not come to the mosque, although that varies. This becomes now culture, not specific theological direction. Women could come to a mosque if there is a special platform for them. So that could serve very well as where women would pray. It could be on the same floor, a kind of a rectangle in the back. That is what most mosques would have, at least traditionally. Nowadays, kind of, there has been much more strictness about that. And the one example which I thought was very, very odd was when they inaugurated the mosque in Florida, where I was, and I was invited to go there. And it's kind of, again, as I say, it's the same thing, but the women were in completely another building. And so what the women had was a large screen that, videotaped and kind of relayed that to the other, to see the imam as he begins his process of prayer and to listen to the khutbah. I must say that the women at that time were very unhappy. You could hear all their anger, and why are we here? We can't be here, but that was the way. And that was a very, very conservative mosque. As I say, nowadays, depending where you are, and this is culture, depending where you are in the Islamic world, will be the kind of mosque that you will have, whether women will be invited to them. You go to Turkey, for instance, all mosques have certain kind of lounges in the back for women. I'm sure you go to Saudi Arabia. I haven't been there, but I would doubt very, very strongly that that would be the case. The mosque in Melbourne was funded by Saudis and Pakistanis, so I think that was why it was so conservative. So that's prayer. Again, important that you have to pray. It is the law. It's not like, now I feel like praying or, I'm too busy. You have to pray 5 times a day. That is the law. So a Muslim, to be a good Muslim, has to do that. The third is fasting. Fasting is kind of the individual sacrifice you make to God. Nowadays, particularly in the Protestant traditions, I don't know, do you have fasting in the Maronite? It's not necessarily, no. Protestant traditions have kind of gone beyond fasting, but Catholics still fast. My mother used to fast in the Eastern Orthodox Church, and by far a harsher fast than others. But fasting has always been part of religion. And it is basically your gift to God, your sacrifice to God. Okay, you can, give God $5 or whatever, but this is something coming out of you. This is something you impose on yourself. And every Muslim should fast. And as I said, not necessarily everyone does, but that is the law. And the fasting, as I say, begins at sunrise, ends at sunset. And of course, with fasting goes also, you don't curse, you don't have sexual intercourse, you don't smoke, you don't drink, it's total fasting. You don't let anything into your mouth. And my sister, who's a doctor in Jordan, always has a big problem. Is an injection breaking the fast? If you're very sick, obviously you need to take it, and that's fine. But it will be a question, should I make up? Okay, I'm supposed to fast for 30 days. Today I had to go and get an injection, or I had to take a medication. If that means I broke my fast, then I'm going to have to fast another day at the end in lieu of this day. But again, it is law. Again, you have to obey. And again, as I say, it is really your ultimate gift, because it's not easy to fast 13 hours a day in Jordan with the heat sometimes in summer, or even here in the United States when you have long, long days and no water, no food, no coffee, no cigarettes, nothing, no chewing gum, nothing at all. So, but that is law, and you obey God. And I've kind of done that a few times. It kind of, at the very beginning, it's very tough. As you go through the month, it gets a bit more manageable. But I did cheat. I would kind of fast during winter. Summer is just too long. Winter is kind of shorter day. And I used to do that when I was a student in AUB, because many of my friends were fasting. And I wanted to see, it's a discipline. And also a mental discipline, because it's natural that you go and get a drink of water, wherever you're walking down the hall and there is a water fountain. And, always keep in mind, you are not to have that. Somehow, it was quite challenging and very educative. You realize that somehow you're giving something. Now, does God need it or not? I don't know. But it's not $10 I put in the tray. It's a harsh requirement that I'm thinking about every day, all the day. The moment, in the morning, you pray, you eat, you fill your tummy. By 10, 11, especially somebody like me, you want to eat. And then 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, you're not drinking. It's not easy. And so you're always thinking about food and drink. You cannot. That's natural. And yet you're also having to think that you're doing that for God. And that's what I found so fascinating. Whether I thought of God or not, more of what I was planning to have for dinner, it was always that this is for God. And again, law. You have to obey. And again, not everyone obeys. The fourth requirement is zakat, is a tithe. It's not charity. It's a tithe. Islam, like Judaism, I don't know, maybe also other Protestant tradition has that, definitely congregation tradition. I don't know, again, if the other traditions have it, where you have to give. It's not that it's a choice, today I feel like I want to help or not. You have to give of your income a certain tithe. The tithe is kind of more or less, generally, is 2.5% of your income. But the point of the tithe is obviously it's going to go to the community, you're helping those in need, in poverty, in persecution, wherever the money needs to go. And again, it's law. It's not that, I don't want to do that. There is charity. You want to give charity. It's another term and another concept. But tithe is what law determines. And that is where, it kind of, all the charities have kind of arisen as a result of these tithes. Finally, the pilgrimage to Mecca. Islam is perhaps the most historically contextualized and accurately historicized religion, because you know exactly where everything happened. In life of Jesus, you can speak about, Bethlehem and Jerusalem and kind of, where he went around. But, where they are, is his birth in Bethlehem, exactly in the church there, where you go down and there are monks praying 24 hours a day, or they should. Sometimes they just take a break. You know, we don't know. The life of Muhammad was detailed in every possible manner. I mean, everything about this man was known. Because there was a large community, he was a very public man, a very interactive man, a military man, a married man, a legalist man. So, I mean, he was there at the center of the community. And all these people saw him, remembered him, some kind of orally transmitted his views. And so, you know exactly where everything happened. The Kaaba is still the same place where it was in the year 670, when 570, when he was born. Now, it's not the same building. It's the same spot that it was. The battles that he fought, won or lost, all these are recognized. There are mosques that are still there from that period, the locations of them. So that's why, in a sense, and again, this is obviously a tradition both in Judaism and in Christianity, of pilgrimage. You go on the pilgrimage to visit the holy sites. Pilgrimage was, still is, a very long process. You know, in medieval period, if you're in Morocco, it's a long walk. If you're in Central Asia, in Iran, in Hindustan, it's a long trek. And yet, the idea is that if you can, you should do it at least once a year. And so, once a lifetime. Once is enough. And actually, nowadays, given the enormous number of people who go, the Saudi government has, which obviously oversees all that, has quotas. So, for instance, from the United States, let's say it will take 50,000 pilgrims. From Lebanon, it will take, let's say, 5,000. You know, whatever. I mean, it has quotas. And clearly, therefore, if you've gone once, it's very unlikely that you're going to be included in the quota for the second time. You can go at other times of the year. It's a kind of the smaller pilgrimage, if you choose, but the big pilgrimage, you know, is that time. Now, the big pilgrimage, the one that you often see on television, and I think last year was like 2.5 million people assembling in Mecca and then trekking to Medina. Mecca is the place. Medina is a choice. You want to go there, that's fine, but Mecca is where you go. That's the center of the pilgrimage. It's fascinating to realize, and with that kind of we conclude where it began, is that the whole pilgrimage process and the whole celebration of it is really to celebrate Abraham and to celebrate Abraham's sacrifice. It's really not Muhammad. Now, Muhammad was there, and you know there are associations with him, as I say, but really the whole pilgrimage site, that the Kaaba itself was a building built by Abraham. It got kind of desecrated and became a house of idols until Islam came and reverted it back to a house of God. But it's celebration, a remembrance of Abraham and Abraham's sacrifice, not of Isaac. The Quran has Ishmael. And so that's a place where every year hundreds of thousands of animals are sacrificed. Again, depending on your wealth or lack thereof, we can kind of 5 or 6 can buy a sheep. I, if I'm wealthy, can, you know, offer 10 sheep. And the Saudi government, again, has done a good job. One of the few things it does well is to, basically freeze those carcasses and send them off to, you know, areas of hunger and poverty. So it's a charity. It's, you give it away. You don't eat it yourself. Even in kind of cities, there you will eat some of it because your children are there and they've seen the sheep and they like, you know. But you also have to give to the poor. So, but the point is, it's Abraham. And that kind of takes us back to the first thing I pointed out, that the beginning of the witness is a recognition of the legacy and the lineage of prophecy from Adam through Abraham, who's a very important figure in the Quran, through the rest of the prophets until Muhammad. So you in the Kaaba region, you're in the house that Abraham built, you're going to the place where Abraham was about to sacrifice his son Ishmael. There is a place just across from the Kaaba where the feet of Abraham have been kind of stamped into the stone, you know, part of belief. So you're reenacting, basically, the whole experience of Abraham, Hagar, and Ishmael. A few years back, there was a big stampede in which sometimes Saudis mess up big time, And that was time they messed up big time, because there was a stampede, and I don't know, hundreds of people were killed. And the stampede is because there is a place you have to run from one place to another. Now it's been built up, but had been at the time. But the point is, you're running from one place to another, exactly reenacting the running of Hagar from where she was left to the fountain from which she went to bring some water for her son. So she ran and then ran back. The fountain is still there, Zamzam, and many kind of pilgrims will return with kind of holy water, although it's not holy, but basically that you bring water from Zamzam. The same way that people going to Jordan River get back some of the water, same kind of idea. But the running is exactly, as I say, the running of Hagar. So you are reenacting the whole experience of Abraham, Hagar, and their son, Ishmael. And so, in a sense, in that respect, Islam kind of brings in this, which is the greater of the two feasts, brings kind of a whole kind of closure to the monotheistic tradition. It began with the revelations through Abraham and has ended in the revelations through Muhammad. Now, that's a lot. What I can do is I can stop here and see if, you know, what questions you have. And I don't know if you want me to talk about Sunni Shiite issue, I can do that, or any other issue that you like me to talk about. Because, as I say, some of you have had experiences, some haven't, and so I kind of would like to know.
When Muslims pray, is it a spontaneous prayer that they're praying, or is it
it's a set prayer.
Preset?
It's a set prayer as you are performing the prostrations. And, you know, as you're bending down, you are repeating the same thing that everybody else is. But obviously you can go earlier and spend half an hour saying your own prayers, and these are your own kind of expression. After the end of the service, again, you can stay there, and a lot of people say, just sit there, and they're either, reciting their own prayers. Sometimes even it becomes an occasion where you just walk to the corner of the mosque where there are some kind of religious texts, and you pick out one and you read some of it. The actual exercise, as I say, is set, but what you do before and after is your own. And as I say, a lot would do that. Not everyone, again.
Yeah, there are aspects of Islam that are real troubling to modernists and Christians. The things on Sharia law and some of the harsher things that we wouldn't consider illegal, and including the punishment of stoning to death that we find troubling.
I agree. Again, we go back that Islam, like Judaism, is a religion of laws. Now, how these laws are to be enacted or interpreted or not enacted is going to be a matter of the community itself. So, for instance, Judaism has laws of, stoning the adulteress. They don't practice that, clearly. So there has been a change in terms of the social legal context within which Islam is. That's why whenever we speak about Islam, I think I always have to ask two questions. Which Islam and where? Muslims in Turkey obey the law of the land, and the law of the land does not allow such punishment. So the law of the land has kind of more or less overridden the law of the Sharia, which some people would find objectionable, but this is the law of the land. Tunisia, for instance, again, the same thing. So in terms of the text, yes, there are these various laws that, clearly draw back on the Israelite tradition, which some Muslim communities have decided these are kind of outdated, unpracticable, and some have not. So that is where culture comes in, rather than theology. Theology is there. It's like, again, with the hijab. It's Quranic. And, if you want to be a good Muslim woman, you have to dress the way that the Quran tells you. But, you know, travel around the Islamic world, and you will find that depending where is the kind of dress that you will have. So it is kind of an issue of culture and of law of the land. In Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, in Morocco, I mean, you know, you can be a very pious Muslim but not dress that way. And these countries will not allow that, you know, the stoning and the, you know, cutting of the hands, etc. They have, in a sense, instituted a set of laws that override the Quranic laws. Other places, like Saudi Arabia perhaps, have kept that. And that's where, as I say, culture and law. And so it's not as much as an indictment of the text, because the text also is, I mean, it's the same text as in Judaism. We don't indict Judaism for having these laws. You don't go around and say Judaism is really a religion of violence, because Jews have moved beyond the application of the Old Testament laws from their social context. Muslims are doing that in varying degrees. Sudan, for instance, there's a desire to return to Sharia. In Afghanistan and Pakistan, there's a desire to return to Sharia. These are problematic. They are disturbing because, kind of, in a sense, they limit individual freedom quite extensively. Why they are there, I think, should be the issue we ask, not what they are, but, you know, why is it that these communities and these societies are bringing or insisting on bringing them back? That would be the issue there. And these are much more social and political than doctrinal. But to answer the question, as I say, I would not indict the text. I would indict, if I choose to indict, and I do, I would indict the application of the text in a context that should have been changed and has been changed in many other parts. I don't know. I mean, I kind of, from what I'm kind of understanding about this, is a sense, is a return to orthodoxy. And my problem is not with that. If you want to practice orthodox Islam in terms of returning to the codes of the Sharia, that's fine, as long as it does not contravene the laws of the land. And obviously you have Orthodox Jews who are, again, living according to their orthodoxy, dressing in that manner, eating in that manner, going to schools in that manner. So you have a model. I mean, I always point it out. I say, I mean, there is a model. If Muslims want to do the same, you can be Orthodox, like the Orthodox Jews, and live a kind of separate community, but with fully implementing the laws that you see are the laws of the scriptures. I find that problematic for both communities, for, you know, anybody who is isolating a community is kind of losing out in terms of the interaction and the growth of society. But that's people's choice, as I say, as long as it does not contravene the law of the land. Now, Dearborn is just a call, but actually in Britain, the Archbishop of Canterbury was saying that we can bring in some of the laws of Sharia into the legal code of Britain. There was a big kind of debate and discussion, controversy about that. It need not be the kind of codes that are repulsive in terms of stoning or cutting off hands. It could be codes of domestic affairs, you know, inheritance, marriage, etc. These kind of, you know, could be structured within the structure, the larger kind of umbrella of the laws of the land. But I don't know. I mean, I agree. It's kind of, if you want to live that way of life, you can. Others are living it. In my view, you lose a lot. That's what I would say.
So in response to the last question, you touched on the theological and cultural traditions around the world. Can you maybe just add a bit about North America and perhaps even locally here in the Twin Cities? What are the main theological and cultural?
I don't know about the Twin Cities at all. And really, I mean, for North America, you need to have somebody else who has studied that. I have studied the history of Islam and its practice within the Arab world. Really, in the United States, I cannot speak with any authority. So I'd rather not do that. And hopefully, I gather you have a speaker coming to speak from the Somali kind of community. She I'm definite will be able to help out. I haven't studied that. I mean, I will speak about what I have studied.
I have a question regarding, you talk about the law and the very legalistic nature of that, and the people that are praying constantly, do they do so out of more of just an obligation, or do they actually have, in essence, a love and a personal relationship with God, or they view God beyond that?
Okay, the God of the Hebrew Scriptures, as is the God of the Quran, is a God of laws and obedience. This issue of love is very problematic. Not that you don't have, in Judaism as in Islam, traditions that will speak of the love of God, particularly the Sufi tradition, I mean, it is overwhelmingly kind of directed in that fashion. But your relationship to God is a relationship of a higher absolute power, unknowable in terms of its infinite magnitude. And that power has revealed itself in law. So if you want to put it that way, to love God is to obey God. And obedience, therefore, is the manifestation, if you want. A Muslim will not really want to push it that far. But obedience is what God wants of you. And obedience is not, for a Muslim, something different from love. That in the Christian tradition, there is that personal relationship because of the whole concept of the incarnation, that you have a man that you can kind of have a picture of. So you can do that. Islam, like Judaism, you don't have pictures. And so it's an authority, it's a power, it's a voice, it's codes. And therefore, the obedience to that power is really your admission of, I don't know if it's love, but definitely it's devotion. Definitely it's piety. Definitely it's a personal relationship. Yes, I and he, as I said, perhaps even more than in the Christian tradition. You come to church, you come as a family. You hold hands. I always found that fascinating. You know, hold hands, you sing together. It's a family activity. I can be with my son and father and brother. And as we pray, we're tunnel visioned on God. My brother or son doesn't exist. At that point, my vision is God. So piety, devotion, I think would be the words to use rather than love in the Christian sense, simply because, as I say, there is no kind of possibility. How can you love that? That was kind of a question that kind of medieval mystics ask. How can you love that which you have not seen or known or you cannot define as God is in the monotheistic tradition, Judaism, Christianity, Islam? I mean, God is ultimately, I mean, a trinity. What is a trinity? It's beyond our reason. It's beyond our understanding. And so the same thing with the other traditions that it is a power, it's a superior entity. We simply obey it, and by obey it, we are showing our devotion. And devotion, devotio, I mean, it's a form of relating, it's a form of engaging. Maybe not love, but definitely a very strong sense of engagement, a personal engagement, very, very personal engagement with God.
Two questions. You may have dealt with this somewhat already. Does the Quran say anything specific about women or how women should be treated? And then secondly, do they make any connection between the fact that Jesus had 30 years on earth and Muhammad, I think you said, had 32 years after he became a prophet?
Okay, to answer the first question, yes, the Quran has a lot about women. And many of the way they are dressed is definitely Quranic. Because, again, some of the material and some of the images are cultural and patriarchal and not Quranic. And historical, but not Quranic. Quranic definitely is the dress. Quranic definitely is that you can marry more than one, up to four, if, however, you can be fair to all of them. You can punish your wife if she disobeys you by beating her. This is, again, Quranic. On the other hand, kind of these are, if you want, the negative sides for us today. On the positive side, again in the 7th century, because this is, again, we have to historicize it. I mean, this is 7th century, women have the right to property, which was not the case at all in Arabia, even in Roman and Greek culture. I mean, so Islam introduced something that's quite different and unique at the time, that women have the kind of financial status to be separate. Women keep their names when they marry. And that's the idea that marriage is a contract, not, you know, an act of union as in the Christian tradition. So my wife could keep her name and not my name. If they choose, they can do that. But so there are kind of, if you want, you know, kind of forward-looking statements in the Quran, and some clearly very, very problematic. Again, this is a matter of how the law of the land is going to handle that. Now, you just heard, for example, I don't know if you've been covering it, but in Afghanistan, a law was being passed that a man can kind of take his wife by force, and that, you know, that's fine. Now, Karazi, because under pressure, is kind of said he's real. Now, this is not Quranic. This is patriarchal. Now, this is where we need to draw a very, very strong line between what kind of theologically is being proposed and what historically, societally, culturally is being imposed. Afghani women are dressed in the burqa. I mean, you've seen pictures. I mean, where else, you know, are they dressed that way? This is not. I mean, in Beirut, in Jordan, in Amman, in Morocco, in Dearborn, in Minneapolis, they're not dressed that way. This is part of the kind of patriarchal and also the politically unstable society of Afghanistan. I mean, imagine a society where you don't have any law and order. I mean, except for a little part of Kabul, the country is really kind of wild. I mean, if you're a woman running around with jeans, you're exposed. I mean, there are bandits, there are people who are criminals, they will abuse you. And indeed, it did happen. I mean, reading accounts of what happened after the fall of Taliban in the wake of the American invasion in 2001, I mean, it was terrifying that women were being raped left, right, and center, that people were being abducted, they were being killed. I mean, once there's no law and order, as all societies, you know, gangsters and bandits and the rest take over. So on one point, as I say, always keep in mind, you know, is this part of Islamic legacy and Quranic teaching, or is it the way society operates? For instance, the facial cover, niqab, this is not Quranic. And yet you go to, I mean, I've seen them, I haven't been there, but I mean, in Lebanon, for instance, we used to have a lot of tourists coming from Dubai, from the Gulf region, from Saudi Arabia, and they would all be covered. You'd just see the eyes. That's culture. That's the husband who insists on that, or at least the woman who insists on that. And it could be women as well. I mean, I'm not putting the blame, but it becomes part of, you know, the cultural identity of that particular society. It's not Quranic. He should not, she should not be completely veiled. You don't need that. The face has to be seen. Well, this is the way they practice it. Now, sorry, what was the second question?
If they make any connection between Jesus having 30 years on earth and Muhammad, I think you said, had 32 years.
Oh, well, in terms of the, no, 22 years of the prophecy. As I say, never compare, and Muslims don't, compare Jesus to Muhammad. You compare Jesus to the Quran. The Quran is the word of God, in the same way that Jesus is the word of God, in the same way that the Torah is the word of God. As I say, that's why I see Judaism and Islam in the concept of word and the concept of covenant very different from Christianity. Christianity kind of humanizes, incarnates the word. Judaism and Islam retains it as language. And that's why, you know, becomes important if you're a rabbi to know Hebrew and Aramaic, if you're a Muslim to learn Arabic, because God spoke that way. Christianity, I mean, you don't need to learn Latin. Anyway, Jesus didn't speak Latin or Greek, you know. And you don't need even to learn Aramaic, because there aren't any Gospels in Aramaic anyway, I mean, until much, much later. So it doesn't matter. The incarnation is an incarnation in a human shape. There, if you want, if I want to use the same word, the incarnation is an incarnation in language. That, as in the Hebrew scriptures, you know, Mount Sinai, God comes down and with his finger kind of carves the Ten Commandments. In the Quran, God, through the angel Gabriel, kind of dictates the message of the Quran. So, and so Muslims, particularly in the Sufi tradition, will make the analogy that, you know, in the same way that the Quran is of God and eternally with God and uncreated, so was Jesus, at least in the Christian Trinitarian tradition, of God, with God, forever and ever, eternally so, uncreated, etc. So you find these wonderful analogies between the Quran as a revelation and Jesus as a revelation. Muhammad, you know, in the Quran, I mean, Muhammad is just mentioned like 4 or 5 times, while Jesus is mentioned like, you know, 20 or 30 times. Moses, Abraham are mentioned hundreds of times. They're much more important. There's a whole surah, there's a whole chapter about Mary. Now, Mary gets kind of, you know, the beginning of the Gospel of Luke, just a little passage there. There you have a full story, which I find always by far more culturally attuned than what Luke said, because Luke was a Greek. He didn't know Semitic society. He didn't know Palestine. The other is talking from within a Semitic society. What would happen if a girl, you know, gets pregnant, doesn't have a husband, and there is no Joseph, by the way, in the Quran at all. Kind of not even an inkling of doubt that it was God's act. So that's why Joseph's kicked out of the picture. So in a sense, you know, that's the kind of analogy that, at least very strongly in the Sufi tradition, you find that being made. So, as I say, Muhammad is just a messenger. And the Quran says that. And actually, after his death, when the community was completely perplexed, I mean, there's a famous statement that was made by the first caliph. He said, if you worshipped Muhammad, Muhammad is dead. So forget about him. But if you worship God, as revealed in the Quran, God is alive. And that, as I say, is the focus in that.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you.